The Ideas Behind Simplicity Parenting, the title to Kim John Payne's book, did not arrive simply, as they represent years of research and work experience in the author's life. But the practice of simple parenting does distill down to a moment in time when we can choose with enlightened decisions to communicate well. Thankfully, Kim is sharing and traveling throughout the world what he's put into his book, and today we'll conclude our discussion we began last week. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries.
Do you see what I mean?
Yes, definitely.
You create outside yourself what you don't want to face inside yourself. And boy, technology is just a huge, huge way of creating outer stimulation rather than face the sort of the difficulties that this time of consciousness brings us.
Yes, and Kim, since you've spoken so well about all of this, what is one thing that comes to mind for you, if it's possible? You know so many things about this, but when you're looking at assisting another being, especially a child, you know, whether it's your child, someone you meet on the street, or your teacher, in assisting them to strike that balance between freedom and responsibility, because as you mentioned, more than ever now, it's huge. Freedoms are huge and responsibilities are huge. They definitely are different sides of the same coin.
Yeah, you know, I'm talking to you from San Francisco, and out my window I can actually see the island of Alcatraz, right? It's a lovely view. And it really was reminding me of something that Viktor Frankl said. He was asked if he could give a gift to the American people, what would it be? And he said, well, you know, my people arrived on the East Coast and sailed right under the Statue of Liberty. And he said, if he could give a gift to the American people on Alcatraz, he would erect the Statue of Responsibility, because only then would the American people be lifted from perpetual adolescence. And it really struck me today, looking at Alcatraz, thinking of Viktor Frankl's word, this balance between freedoms and responsibilities. And I think you mentioned children, Robin, and I think one of the key pieces of advice I would give parents around children is that we sometimes misunderstand what freedom and choices actually mean, and we give little children way too many choices way too young. They cannot handle the amount of choices that are coming at them, and many, many parenting books actually advise parents to do this. Now, I think giving choices is a good thing to do, but not when they're little. It's almost like we've got our parenting back to front. We parent little children like they're teenagers, giving them loads and loads of choices way ahead of their neurological ability to make them. And then when they get to teens and they're cutting loose and they no longer respect our authority because
we
parented them like they're little buddies, like they're our equals, then the genie is not going to go back in the bottle. You know, when we try and sort of pour it all back in again because we realize they're getting into trouble and there's a lot of risks out there, they won't go. So, you know, I think it's got to do with giving little children a childhood, and there's a kingly or a queenly principle where we let them know that we're doing this because mommy or daddy knows what's right for them, and then when they're teenagers, like 9, 10, 11, 12, that's more of like, I think of that like a farmer. You know, we collaborate with them a little bit. We work things out together, but we still don't give them a lot of choices. Ultimately, we'll listen to them, but ultimately, a parent will make a decision. and let them know what that decision is and stick to it. And then in the teen years, that's more like a shepherd because then they're going to go where they're going to go, but we try and anticipate and advise. So we move from a kingly principle to a gardener or farming principle in their tweens to then the shepherding principle. And if provided we do that, our kids will be in really, really good shape because then they learn to control their impulses. They learn to delay gratification. They learn timing. They learn to be team players. And then when they get to their teens, they're in good shape.
Well, I hope a lot of people are listening. I just love that scenario you drew for us. I think it's very important for parents of kids these days. I wish I did that a little better when I was raising mine because
that's
very true. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, we have the grandchildren.
But, you know,
now.
Robert, it's not too late. You know, if a child is when parents, you know, I'm a family counselor, and if a parent comes into my room and saying, you know, my child is just making loads and loads of bad choices, there's no good at going at a child who's 13, 14, 15 about the bad choices they're making. Basically, you need to take them back to a much earlier stage, and you need to just take them back to that earlier principle of that kingly or queenly principle. And for 3 or 4 months, you just haul everything back in, and even at the age of 14, in a way that's dignified. You don't want to treat them like little babies, but if they're making bad choices, there's no good just keeping on telling them they're making bad choices.
Right.
It's time to bring the boundaries in, and bring the boundaries in lovingly but close and warm, and then start releasing them out. So once they've got that, then the next stage is that gardening principle where they realize they're a part of a family's ecosystem, that what they do affects other people. What they do affects their brothers and sisters. It affects their mum and dad. And that's that gardening stage because they're a part of that family, the family garden, really, the family ecosystem. It's a family. It's very interdependent on each other. And then you can start talking to kids about that. Now, you could say, well, I wish my kids had have got that at the age of 12 or 11 when they should have. But there's no should here. It's just if they didn't get it, that's okay. Just back up and help them get it.
Yeah, it's never too late. I was just listening to a tape earlier from this spiritual healer, and he had gone into prison in England, actually, and the minister that would speak to the prisoners every week had him in, so he had to listen to the minister talk, and then he was able to speak, and he noticed when all the prisoners were leaving his talk, they were light, they were shaking hands, and the whole feeling was different. And the minister or priest or whoever he was noticed the same thing. And he said, wow, how come, you know, they're never like that after I speak? And, you know, he's the spiritual man, right? And so the spiritual healer said, well, I could barely sit through it. You made me feel like, you know, they walk in feeling like a sinner because they're in prison, and you just, you know, drilled that into their heads more and more and more the whole time, and I didn't judge them.
Right. Well, you know, we are well and truly good enough at beating ourselves.
Exactly.
Up,
yes.
You know, and knowing our weaknesses without anyone, you know, assisting us to do that. And it's for me, it's got to do with understanding the difference between what I think of as our sphere of concern and our sphere of influence. Like our sphere of concern for the planet, for our economy, with technology, for education, you know, for our families, our sphere of concern is really large, and it's almost overwhelming, particularly if we listen to the news too much and we just keep, you know, getting panicked. And we're really, really concerned about how things are going, and that's a big concern. What's much more modest is our sphere of influence. And what we can influence is not to be underestimated. Even though it's smaller, it's just wonderful to back up and just start thinking, well, what can I actually, What can I actually do? I mentioned a minute ago, if we're really concerned about technology overwhelming our kids, well, then let's give it. Let's get our homes to be really, very, very technologically free. If we're really concerned about gross materialism and just this rampant consumerism, well, then let's be really careful with what of the kind of toys we buy our kids. Let's just not have Christmas be this sort of toy tsunami. There are absolutely things that we can do that are in our sphere of influence, and not start, you know, avoid the trap of only looking at this very large sphere of concern, because that becomes anxiety producing,
well,
or
fear.
Alternatively just depressing.
Yes.
And so just acting out of what we can actually do, and just taking those simple first steps. I mean, that's really why I wrote one of the main reasons I wrote the book, the Simplicity Parenting book, is because it's the steps that we can take actually can be simple and humble. And I can't tell you how many parents have just done some very simple little things in their homes that I, you know, sort of outline in the book. And we have these Simplicity Parenting group leaders all around the country now who are convening these little groups, you know, of parents coming in and saying, like, I often think they come in and say, like, hi, I'm Kim, I'm a complex parent, and you know, and they meet together and they support each other in taking these small and simple doable steps, and then the world doesn't feel so overwhelming.
Right. Well, you just mentioned that they have groups, but I noticed you also have a discussion forum online for parents or teachers that are reading your book, Simplicity Parenting. And I'm wondering, what are you learning from that?
Oh, great question. I'm learning so much. You know, I'm learning how people the creativity of people in how they bring about change and the awakening, as we were mentioning right at the beginning of when we were talking about awakening to how to live in a post-excess culture, is incredibly creative. We have people making all kinds of small and doable changes, and I'm also learning about how activism can be quiet. It can be simple and quiet, because we have, you know, we train these Simplicity Parenting group leaders, and it's a very simple little training, because the irony of having a complex training would be lost on that one, I hope. And the we have this simple little training, and then these people, out they go, and they convene their own groups. There are some guidelines for how to help them do that. And the amazing thing is to see this movement spreading all around the world, with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people bringing this message, and seeing these kind of campfires, you know, metaphorically speaking, but these campfires starting all around the world of people who want to simplify their families' lives. And I guess the outstanding thing that I've come to see is that when we simplify our homes, what it does is it brings about a connection to our kids. But even more than that, if there's one thing that is even perhaps more important than connecting to our kids, it's connecting to ourselves. Because this fast-paced sensory tsunami that adults are facing on a day-to-day basis is getting in between ourselves and our really deeply held values. And when people are starting to get shape back in their lives and get their shape back again, what's happening is that they're connecting to not just to their kids, but to themselves.
Of course.
This is thrilling. It's wonderful to see this happening on such a large scale.
Well, I remember feeling, you know, I'll say quite young, maybe at 20, after I'd left home a few years, and thinking about it, I really felt even then that the most important lessons I learned from growing up in the household that I did, it was all the unspoken. It was nothing that my mother or father or sisters or anyone told me.
And you know, it sounds to me like you know, growing up in a home where there was an underpinning of people living out of a sort of fairly strong foundation. You know, I think many of us are somewhat interested in people's philosophies. The philosophies are kind of interesting, or you know, they can even, you know, if someone goes on about them too much, it can be just annoying. But anyway, it's kind of interesting, someone's philosophy. And what someone does, well, what someone does is kind of interesting as well, maybe. But I think what most people are interested in, and I'm dynamically interested in, how those two things marry, and how we take our philosophies and we take our actions and actually bring them together in our simple daily social engagements. And when someone is bringing those two things together, as a parent or as a coworker, in whatever realm, when those two things are moving together, then you've got someone standing on much, much surer ground. And, you know, I can't tell you how many people as a therapist I've treated over the years as that have experienced a very painful separation between ideals and values and philosophy and what they're able to do in the world. And as they slowly begin to move those things together and have convergence, even the direction that they're moving together, then health on all its levels starts to make itself felt.
Oh,
and it's
sure.
A wonderful thing to see.
Yeah, there's such a peace in that it creates so much space.
Mm-hmm.
Even in that time while you are trying to figure out how to really incorporate all of those things smoothly into your own being, when you...
And, you know, and nowhere is that probably more at a cutting edge than in our family life. When we're standing on ground that where our philosophies and ideals are converging, or at least moving in the same directions as our actions, then we're raising children who have that sense of security within the home. Because this is also what's happening a lot, is that we're hearing a lot of comments about how when parents need now to correct their children or even discipline their children, when they simplify and start to not overschedule so much, when they start to simplify the toys and the books in their homes, when they start to cut back on all the digital overload, the screens, the TVs, and they just start to actually calm their lives down, what happens is that when they come to correct their kids, it's really much, much easier. It's a much more malleable kind of situation, because, you know, we all remember that. You know, remember when your dad or your mum would say something and you'd look at him and you think, oh, I better do that. They really mean that. And it's not like they're shouting. In fact, often it's because they, you know, a parent will go quieter.
Right.
I find the gesture of really good discipline, you know, is spatially is when you sort of come back into yourself and you move down. It's a sort of it's an in and down, whereas so often we can find ourselves going up and out and speaking in a squeaky little voice when our kids aren't, you know, behaving very well. And that whole thing of standing on firm ground is so wonderful to see so many parents being able to do that and not having to take parenting classes around discipline. Discipline is just the outcome. The word discipline, of course, comes from the word disciple, you know, being worthy of being followed. And when we're standing on simple, calm ground, then our kids will follow our directions.
I like that, the disciple. I never thought of those two, and of course they are directly related.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, one thing, Kim, I'd like to ask you about is that as this evolution that we're in right now, with all of the boundaries being pushed and, you know, freedom and responsibility just being huge and seemingly out of control, what do you see moving from here? It's, I feel like, you know, of course it's opening up for spiritual advancement and it's opening up for fear advancement and war advancement, but is there something that you see that all of this is heading in a direction and actually allowing for more of that spirituality? I mean, reading some of your things, I felt like I was, it's like, okay, we're heading toward Lemuria again, where they had all of the creative side, but then something came along and, you know, the island or Atlantis went down because they got into the warring end of things. And I'm not really saying that, you know, we're on the precipice right this moment or anything, because I don't feel like we are, but I feel like this is really opening a door for spiritual advancement. And that, of course, includes artistic and creative development. And I'm wondering if you could speak to things you see that could maybe get us working more on that side of creation and artistic abilities and the spiritual advancement, rather than feeding into the fear, which is the huge thing that this culture seems to want to plaster everywhere.
Great question and observation. My point of clarity, perhaps, about that is that of the social arts. I think there are of course many art forms, but the social arts, what I particularly mean by where we're headed in that is the challenge of engagement versus disengagement. I really do see that as the crucial question of our time, and the way we answer that is going to be seminal in how our children and grandchildren and many, many generations from here are going to grow and for the environment they're going to grow up in. At the moment, we have the hugest possibility to disengage from each other. We have the possibility to isolate and disengage. And I don't just mean Facebook or, you know, virtual networking. What I mean is that that happens when we're standing at the counter of the supermarket. Do we actually greet the person or genuinely ask how you doing?
I hate that when they're not even looking at you and they say, how are you? And I feel like, well, you're not even looking at me, so I guess
right,
I don't need
exactly
to answer.
And just pausing a little moment when someone's not even looking at you saying, how you doing? And they're not even looking and just saying, well, I'm doing all right, but what do you think about? And then and engaging just that little bit. We have how we engage, how we disengage with each other, how we disengage in our families or engage, how we make spaces for connection and disconnection, how sports coaches of kids start to actually see, to connect with the children that they're actually having that significant responsibility. So do they connect with the children, or do they just want to take that little league team out and just and win and be successful? Is it about humanizing? Is it about dehumanizing? Is it about connecting or disconnecting? Because I've worked in reconstruction zones, in war zones, all around the world, and a number of them, and I see the terrible toll that dehumanizing can have. And I was just in Boulder, in Colorado, down your way, actually, recently, Robin, and I was talking to a group of high school children at the Shining Mountain Waldorf School, and what an amazing bunch of high school kids, because we were having a conversation. I was talking to them about how, you know, I've worked in all these different places around the world, which sounds in some ways, glamorous is a funny word to say, but you know, it may sound that way to high schoolers. And I was talking to them about the terrible situations of genocide that I've witnessed firsthand in the world. And I said to them, you know, do you think you have to get out there and go and work in Rwanda and Bosnia and South Africa, apartheid South Africa, or whatever? Do you think you have to do that to make a difference? What else can you do to make a difference? And the point that came up in our conversation was, actually, you make a decision about whether you step towards warfare and genocide every time you walk down a corridor with a friend and you either diss them, put them down, or you see a kid you don't like and you diss them, or you don't. Because dehumanizing, it exists on a big old worldwide macro scale, but it also exists in the social arts of how we talk to each other. And we can dehumanize someone in an eye blink. And the gesture is no different to, it's identical. The inner gesture is identical to what I've seen in the world in these terrible aftermath of genocide. And so to come full circle in answering your question, Robin, that's why I talk about disconnecting and connecting, rehumanizing and dehumanizing. I honestly think that is going to set the scene for many, many generations to come. Only the way we work with that is in our encounters every single day. We have decisions to make about how we engage with people, whether we humanize them or dehumanize them.
You know, the reason why I asked you that very first question about how you came to do this work was because I feel like there's such a spiritual basis to what you're doing. Do you want to comment on that at all? Do you have a specific practice that you do?
No, for me the point of spirituality for me is beautifully, colorfully, multi-layered. It moves from ritual. It moves from outer ritual to inner meditation. But for me, the meditation that I practice is actually in the meeting from one to another every day. What we've been doing now in our conversation, Robin, is for me spiritual practice. The way in which two people engage, the way in which you have created a space and ask these very thoughtful questions, which have asked me to go inwards and think about this, the way in which we've engaged now is of itself a social meditation. And I see that as my spiritual practice. That is really, for me, the key of it. I can no longer just go to church and absolve myself of whatever I may have been doing that I wasn't proud of. I have to actually go back to the people that I did that to and actually meet them and put it right in the world, not just feeling that someone has the power to absolve me of it. Only I have the power to absolve me of that.
Well, I have to say that was quite a pleasure to be able to share Kim John Payne and his work and book, Simplicity Parenting. He's got a website with the same name, simplicityparenting.com. And for any guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.org. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.